Eugene Housing and Neighborhood Defense, or HAND, is an organization in Eugene and Springfield, Oregon, dedicated to defending neighborhoods from capitalist exploitation at the hands of landlords, developers, and other class enemies. On August 4th at the Eugene Unitarian Universalist Church, HAND held a benefit for Eugene jail support as part of their monthly public meeting. Harpist Vele, Lazarus Pearl, and Big Scare provided atmosphere for a small but supportive crowd. I've withheld the speakers' names to protect the innocent.
We're gonna have a number of fun things today. We've got some lovely musical performances. We have some great tables over here with some local groups. I encourage you all to take a look at what they've got going on. We've got an arts and crafts station. We also have a wonderful raffle. With some really cool prizes. We've got a cool print, we've got a cool book, we've got some handmade ACAB booty shorts, and we also have, we're raffling off the first whack of our Chief Skinner pinata. So some great prizes.
Eugene Jail Support needs money to keep your friends and neighbors out of jail.
Hey y'all, with Eugene Jail Support. We are a group of people who do anti-repression organization and education around town. We do some security culture trainings. We do some recommending, like sending people to lawyers and other resources. And we help out with a jail sit that happens Mondays and Fridays outside the Lane County Jail. People sit outside of the jail with food, cigarettes, whatever people need as they're getting out. Our number is 541-515-5721. Can everyone say that for me? 541-515-5721. Call that if any of your homies ever are in jail and needing some help.
A police encounter was recounted.
So in May, on May 1st, Eugene Hand, along with RWC, Revolutionary Women's Committee, put on an event for May Day, and also an event, it was for May Day, and it was in solidarity with teachers in the community who were being absolutely screwed over, just kind of in every way. We put on this event, we had a march, we had speeches, there were chants, that sort of thing. And afterwards, we had a potluck in the Rose Garden, a very lovely potluck in the Rose Garden. And you would think that we were doing something insidious or suspicious, because the whole time we were there, lurking literally in the bushes, were a dozen or so EPD piggies. They were in the back. If you're familiar with the Rose Garden, you know, you've got roses and you've got a fence behind there. They were literally behind the fence, in the bushes, Homer Simpson style, just watching. They were just walking, they were blocking off the exit. They were kind of all around, just watching us eat hot dogs and pasta salad. Great use of their time, I am sure. You know, we didn't think too much of it. However, we did realize that, you know, during the march, there was an attempted disturbance by a notorious doxer, a right-wing chud, a really vile human being who has done pretty much, I don't even want to like name all the things that he's done and posted in support of online because it's disgusting. He was trying to dox people, came in there with a camera, and he was, you know, firmly asked to leave multiple times, escorted out, he refused to leave, eventually he did leave, and it turns out this little man squealed to the pigs themselves, and yes, boo. So, of course, you know, What did the cops do? Oh, they took the side of this chud, and they believed him. And what they did was, one of our comrades who was leaving the park with a couple others, was profiled and surrounded by 20 to 30 bike cops, thrown on the ground. The other people around her were hit with bikes, and this comrade was arrested. So these cops, with no evidence, targeted an activist and took the word of this asshole point blank. And that's fucking bullshit. Can I get an A-C-A-B, all cops are bastards, A-C-A-B,
all cops are bastards.
That's a classic. So, this comrade was arrested. Luckily, thanks to support and help from our comrades, Eugene Jail Support, they got out that night. Because thanks to our friends at the CLDC, all the charges were dropped. Because they were baseless, they were bullshit, and this guy, Max Carson, is a bozo who deserves to be run out of town, and that's a nice thing to say. Thanks to our friends at Eugene Jail Support and CLDC, comrade safe and sound. And this is one of the reasons why groups like this are so important, right? We should be able to feel, it is scary to stand up for what you believe. It is scary to go to protests. It's scary to stand outside of the federal building and see these boys with their gear on, with their rifles. It's scary. And no one would say it's not. Some people have done it more and they feel more comfortable, but at the end of the day, you are putting your body on the line. And there are a few things that help keep us safe in an unsafe situation. One is numbers. So get out there. Go to things, go to the federal courthouse. When you see a post of an event, when you hear about something, go out there, grab a friend or two, because we have the numbers, and that's one of the ways to keep us safe. The other way is by having organizations like Eugene Jail Support there, so if you do get scooped, they can get you out if you don't have the funds on you. CLDC to hopefully defend you if it comes to that. Yeah, so I just want to give it up to these two groups and all the other people here in support, so let's give a round of applause.
Hand uses historical victories to show that when organized en masse, working people have the power to collectively halt evictions, rent hikes, housing discrimination, and so much more. Through mutual aid networks and education about the current rentier police state, they believe they can and will facilitate the inevitable downfall of capitalism and create a world where we can manage our housing together. More info at eugenehand.org and the Civil Liberties Defense Center at cldc.org. Eugene Jail Support has Linktree, Venmo, and Instagram sites with donation info. Eugene Jail Support has been bailing people out since at least the 90s at this number, 541-515-5721.
Helplessness is
Nonviolent Peace Force reimagines security and civilian protection in areas most impacted by conflict by working alongside communities to interrupt and prevent violence. Their evidence-informed, civilian-led approaches have protected tens of thousands of people around the world since their launch in 2002, impacting millions more and helping communities live free from fear and become equipped to protect themselves and create sustainable peace. Radically centering those most impacted by violence, NP champions unarmed civilian protection, or UCP, using encouragement and deterrence rather than violence and fear. As fully committed partners, NP teams strategically remain in areas experiencing violence for sustained time because they witness on a daily basis how active nonviolence de-escalates one flare-up at a time. John Malkin from the Independent Media Center and K-Squid interviewed Anna Zoros, Director of Advancement for Nonviolent Peace Force.
I think people would be interested to hear about strategies that Nonviolent Peace Force uses and other groups use in situations where there is violence happening in the moment. When people are shooting at each other or harming each other, in what ways does NP interact in communities when that's happening? I know there's specific practices like unarmed civilian protection and unarmed accompaniment, accompanying people who have been threatened because they are activists or journalists, things like that. In kind of the front lines of violence, how is Nonviolent Peace Force present?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the most important thing I want to name is that no matter what the violent conflict situation is, there's always space for peace. And I think that that's very easy to think that's not possible. So for example, when we went into Ukraine for the first time, it was about 4 months after the full-scale invasion of Russia and Ukraine. And our first reaction was there's being bombs and shelling every day. Like, what can unarmed civilian protection even do in that situation? Our first reaction was, I don't know if we can operate in this kind of, you know, full-scale war type of landscape. A lot of our work had been much more locally based intercommunal violence. And so an international war felt different. Our teams did go in to do an assessment and found that there is still space. And so, for example, in Ukraine, our work has looked a lot like protecting the frontline protectors. So local, we went in to do this assessment and found that there was this whole network of local Ukrainians. It was fishing associations and women's groups who mobilize to keep people safe or to distribute aid where people, when people, like, aid was being dropped in central city locations and people who had mobility issues or were in far-flung reaches of that province couldn't get aid. Just local Ukrainians were jumping in their car, driving to the front line, finding families who need to be evacuated and driving them back out. So in that situation, our role was to support, and still is to support them. And that has really, you know, at first they needed helmets and flak jackets to stay safe. They also needed shelters or safe houses where people could go to after they've been evacuated. Now we've created a whole, what we call a duty of care package, where local Ukrainians can have life insurance, they can get psychosocial support. And then there's technical pieces too, right? The shellings have really transitioned quite a bit into more the use of drones. And we're seeing this in the Middle East now too. And the drones don't get detected in the same way that, in missile defense systems, they fly literally under the radar. So then we started helping local Ukrainians use frequency analyzers. So a frequency analyzer can pick up the signal of the drone, and then someone is able to have a few extra split seconds to race their car to 90 miles an hour to get out of range of that drone, right? So there, this just in one country program is a wide array of ways that we can keep people safe when there's active violence. I would also say that one place where we've worked and some stories that comes to mind too is the Philippines. We've been in the Philippines in the southern region, Mindanao, since 2007. Now there's a peace agreement, but there wasn't when we were there, when we first started being there. When we, in the early days of our work there, there was a ceasefire agreement, but there were still active skirmishes and violence. But because we had really deep trusted relationships in the community and we were official nonpartisan observer of the peace agreement or of the ceasefire agreement, we were able to directly intervene when either a skirmish had happened and we could create humanitarian corridors to get civilians out when there was firefighting happen, or stop it before it even started. So one of my coworkers, Daphne, has this great story. She told me about how they would bring the leaders of the armed forces of the Philippines and the group they were fighting, the Moro Islamic Liberation Front, to meetings in their office. And someone would always have to stay outside in the van with all their guns because they couldn't bring their guns in. And our two staff who led these meetings were both women because it was a strategic choice. They were less threatening and they could sort of calm everyone down in a way that like another man in the room couldn't. And the community trusted our staff so much, our staff are of the community there, that, you know, they would call us and say, we see the armed forces of the Philippines moving on one side of our village, and we see the Moro Islamic Liberation Front moving on another side of the village. There are these local units moving closer, and we're all getting really scared. And in real time, sometimes our staff in that office would then turn to the leaders of these armed groups and say, you guys need to call these units back. And we would be, and they would do that, and they would be responsive because we had again built the trust and the relationship. So there is always room for keeping people safe or actively de-escalating conflicts.
Malkin asked Anna Zoros of NP about her work in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Yeah, I'm a little like, where do I even start? But I'm going to start on the morning that Renee Good was murdered. The ICE surge here in Minneapolis started in mid-December. It started hitting the news about in January, but it started in mid-December. So, you know, my family and lots of other families at my kids' school is situated just a few blocks from where Renee was murdered. And so for weeks already, we had been driving kids to school. At one point, the parents were collectively driving 20% of kids to school. So that morning, actually at like 7 a.m., we had already been hearing of a lot of ICE activity just right around the school. And so we have our signal chats to communicate all that. And when I pulled up to the school, it was actually we had been driving kids for a long time, but this was the first morning where there was a whole ring of parents and community members just around the entire perimeter of the school. And it was beautiful. It's incredible to see that many people show up. And also I was crying. I was like, why do we have to create a safety perimeter around our school? Right. This shouldn't be the world that we live in. And then we have it is literally a caravan of minivans lined up with, you know, mostly white moms, you know, holding the hands of like a gaggle of like 5 to 10 little kids, making sure they get to school. And so it's been deeply beautiful to be in community in this way. But that morning you could feel the tensions rising. And I actually sent a message to our executive director, who's my boss. And I said, it's going to get way worse here. The violence is going to escalate and I might not be at work. And just 10 minutes after that, the news of Renee's shooting had broken. So, I think that there's so much I could say about this. I feel grateful to be in a place where we had such a legacy of organizing, and it goes back to George Floyd, but it goes back even farther than that to Winston Smith's killing, Philando Castile, Jamar Clark. You know, there's a huge Black Lives Matter movement in the Twin Cities, and they have very strongly shown up around ICE Out work. Before that, it is the American Indian movement in the 60s. Before that, it's a really strong labor movement. I think anyone who, I'm a transplant to Minnesota, and one of the first things you are oriented to is Paul Wellstone's, who was a very beloved politician in Minnesota. And he has a famous quote, "We all do better when we all do better." And that is a mantra you learn and are oriented to when you get here. And I think for me, seeing there is just so much damage, and that damage is going to last for a very long time. And ICE is still here. You know, they're announcing that there is the surge is over, but basically they've moved out of Minneapolis and are now targeting more rural and suburban communities. And the damage will be lasting. There, you know, we talked to the teachers about the learning loss of kids who couldn't come to school for those few months, for example. The economic impact is going to take a very long time to heal from. And we also gained. We gained the knowledge that we are here for each other. It was very much one of the people that I have learned a lot of unarmed civilian protection work from, and who has taught me the tactics of de-escalation and that sort of thing, and situational awareness. He would say, "No one's coming to save us but us." And that, I very deeply lived that in Minneapolis. Like, even our local government didn't move fast enough, or didn't help at all, or actively were engaged with ICE. And it was only the community that was showing up for ourselves.
Nonviolent Peace Force is a means to the social justice movement end.
I think, again, personally, unarmed civilian protection, the work we do at Nonviolent Peace Force, is abolitionist. So not everyone would agree with me on that per se, but that's what I think. And I think that a pushback to an abolitionist worldview that I've heard is, oh, you just want to tear things down. Like, you just want to defund police, or you just want to abolish ICE. And like, well, what would we do then? When, if you read abolitionists, if you read Ruth Wilson Gilmore, if you read Miriam Kaba, it's about building something. It's not about taking it down. And sure, there are things we want to end. We want to end the violence, but we end the violence by building systems and communities and cultures rooted in transformative justice, in restoration, in accountability. You know, our violent systems now actually do not hold anyone accountable in any way that is restorative or reparative to a relationship, to a break. So I think that we need to stand more firm in that. You know, after George Floyd was murdered, I remember most of our city council standing on a platform that said defund police written along the bottom. And then it just kind of fizzled away because they hit roadblock after roadblock. And it was a political moment that people felt inspired by, but they actually hadn't done the work, in my opinion, of what that worldview, what it actually takes to get to that worldview, right? When we're focused on abolitionism is a political point to score rather than a complete worldview and culture change, then we're not going to win, right? We win when we really stand firm and know we don't have to live this way. And there are better ways to do this. And it is about creating something that fully repairs from harm. So yeah, I mean, and I think you could take any kind of conflict situation in our communities and in our cultures and kind of break it apart with an abolitionist worldview in terms of how you would actually specifically address it. And Miriam Cobb actually has like a great essay where she envisions abolitionist community and that someone murders someone else. And then what practically is actually done. And that person is held accountable. So we can do that, and we need to stand firm in that. That is real possibility in our world if we stick to it.
Women's traditional role in the family is effectively a type of conflict resolution.
And we talk about ancestral technologies because it is something we believe it is something so innate to us, right? Even here in Minneapolis, no one asked someone to go give another family member a ride or to create mutual aid networks, right? There was no permission given. We just, this is what we are naturally going to do. We're naturally going to stand up for people when unarmed civilian protection feels like this maybe technical or too hard to grasp concept. I ask people to think about, remember when you walked your friend home at night because it was safer for the two of you to walk together? That's unarmed civilian protection. And across our country programs, we see the role of women so powerfully. In South Sudan in particular, we have women's protection teams. And they are, you know, women, I think, have this unique experience because of how we're socialized and because of how we're situated in community, that oftentimes women have access that men don't in conflict settings. In the Philippines, for example, there was this group called the Bangsamoro Indigenous Women's Auxiliary Brigade. And these were women who during the conflict were wives and family members of the Moro Islamic Liberation Front. And the women would be the ones who would go to the bridge and set the bomb, for example, so that the armed forces of the Philippines couldn't cross the bridge into a community. And they could do that because they fly under the radar and they can have access in ways that men can't in conflict settings because they're viewed as someone who is more of a risk or more of a threat. So that Bangsamoro Indigenous Women's Auxiliary Brigade is now working in their community. They are, you know, de-weaponized, right? And they are now creating education initiatives in their community and setting up micro enterprise groups because they have the network of the families and the communities and can, you know, that gave them access before and that gives them to in a violent situation. And now when they've decided to turn over and be a peace institution in their community, they can flip that access on its head for nonviolence. So, and in South Sudan, we see things like, you know, when women individually would go out to collect firewood, they had really high risks of assault. But then, you know, we've worked in local communities to help the women organize together around, well, why don't you move together to collect firewood? And we'll communicate with the armed groups when you're moving through to leave you alone. And we'll accompany you if you need us to. But eventually those women became leaders in their community. They became identified. They would teach other people about women's rights and sexual and gender-based violence to reduce those risks over time. So it started with just collecting firewood together and then has eventually evolved to having real stance in their communities. And some of them have been elected to local councils and things like that too. So, and there's a, I'm not going to remember her name, but there is a sociologist who did research about how in traumatic situations, you know, we have fight, flight, or freeze response, but she had done some research that women had the response of together. And so, you know, when trauma can trigger our brain to make us shut down or be antagonistic towards someone else, women have often been socialized in a way that says, no, let's bring you in. And so those are skills and experiences that are hugely valuable when we're trying to build nonviolent and abolitionist communities.
Just like they tell you on the playground, bullies are insecure.
The anger felt towards ICE agents was something that I needed to process, right? That I know that deep down, we're not getting out of this if we stop at you're a horrible human being for doing this in my community, get out, right? Yes, we need to stop that violent actions, but we still need to see the humanity in that person and invite them into a different way of being. So yeah, I would say, you know, if folks are interested in learning more about Nonviolent Peace Force, they can go to our website, nonviolentpeaceforce.org, and especially see some of the work we're doing in the United States. We just put out some really great stories about the communities we work with and how, especially in New York and San Diego, and how they're experiencing increases in violence, whether that's violence directed at them or threats directed at them because of their identity or, you know, an overreach of state violence, an escalation of use of violence by state actors, and how we've been adapting to support them in these times and doing a lot of role plays so people can embody what it would feel like if they're faced with that threat. And really, that's something I talked about a lot to my communities in Minneapolis of, you know, it takes a lot of work to do nonviolence.
Through direct protection, advocacy, and trainings in person and online, the National Peace Force expands access to life-saving peace strategies and an actionable way forward to a violence-free tomorrow. For more information, go to nonviolentpeaceforce.org. On July 22, 2026, in Atlanta, Georgia, three federal judges in the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, Chief Judge William Pryor, Judge Jill Pryor, and Judge Andrew Brasher, heard oral arguments in the appeal of the 2024 unconstitutional conspiracy conviction of the Uhuru III. From a statement from the Hands Off Uhuru website, a Tampa jury had acquitted 84-year-old veteran African liberation fighter Chairman Amali Yeshitela and two white reparations organizers, Penny Hess and Jesse Neville, of serving as secret agents of Russia, but contradictorily convicted them on the secondary false charge of conspiracy to be secret agents of Russia, all because they had expressed opinions opposing the U.S. support for Ukraine, along with advocating for reparations to African people and charging the U.S. with genocide in its treatment of black people. This precedent-setting anti-colonial free speech fightback has won international and national support from First Amendment defenders and social justice activists from across the political spectrum, including the National Lawyers Guild, the Civil Liberties Defense Center, the National Conference of Black Lawyers, the Center for Political Innovation, the U.S. Peace Council, U.S. Hands Off Cuba Committee, former New York City Councilman Charles Barron, Dr. Cornel West, Jimmy Dore, Max Blumenthal, Dr. Gerald Horn, and Tucker Carlson. During the 2024 trial, the Uhuru III's legal team convinced the jury that the opinions expressed by Yeshitela were his own and not directed by the Russian government by showing print and video evidence of Yeshitela's activism spanning decades. Chairman Amali's published writings showing a consistent worldview of African internationalism and anti-colonialism can be read in 58 years of the Burning Spear newspaper, freely available in the University of Florida's digital newspaper collection. In the past 5 decades, he has traveled to 17 countries to speak to audiences, including in 2019 as the winning presenter at the Oxford Union's Africa Debate. He has been interviewed and featured on platforms such as CNN, Democracy Now!, Al-Mayadeen, Press TV, and countless national and international radio stations, podcasts, and newspapers. The DOJ had argued that the Uhuru III are engaging in spreading disinformation, quote, even if the information is true, but it makes the government look bad, close quote. In their earlier motion to dismiss, attorneys for the Uhuru III argued the government here is using a federal criminal statute to prosecute members of an activist group for political speech and activism in opposition to U.S. foreign policy. In so doing, this prosecution strikes at the heart of the First Amendment. This is the first case in which the government has used the statute that criminalizes unregistered foreign agents, 18 U.S.C. 951, to target political or dissenting speech. In short, if this case is allowed to go forward, it will reverse more than 8 decades of Supreme Court precedent that prohibits the government from targeting dissenting political speech and dissent. The appeal of the Uhuru III's false conviction on the lesser charge of conspiracy was filed a year ago on June 16, 2025. It argues 3 points: that the lower court's finding that lawful political speech loses its First Amendment protections when the speaker is alleged to be a Russian agent should be reversed. The government presented insufficient evidence of a conspiracy. The government presented insufficient evidence of a conspiracy as it presented no evidence as conceded by the government's own case agents. The jury was misled to believe that it could convict the defendants on the conspiracy charge, despite the absence of evidence as to the underlying crime. More than 80 Uhuru 3 supporters packed the Atlanta courtroom again on July 22nd, spilling into an overflow room where attendees watched the proceedings on closed-circuit TV. Notable figures attending the hearing including attorney Mawuli Davis, national co-chair of the National Coalition of Black Lawyers, Belinda Parker Brown of Louisiana United International, Afia Nwangaza, veteran of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and Malcolm X Center for Self-Determination, John McCarthy of the Center for Political Innovation, Mark Friedman of the U.S. Hands-Off Cuba Committee, and Paulette Dottiel of the Jericho Movement and Leonard Peltier Ad Hoc Defense Committee. Uhuru Movement commentator Dana Lamamumba Janiba, the Southern Regional Representative of African People's Socialist Party and granddaughter of Yeshitela, gives us the lowdown.
I just want to reiterate, it says here, I think that it's really precedent setting when we read that only a fifth of federal appeals in this country were granted oral argument hearings. And I have to repeat it because I think it's just so incredibly profound when we think about, Chairman always says, it's not just the right to free speech, but it's also your right to hear what is being said, and particularly anti-colonial free speech is what Chairman O'Malley Yeshitela is fighting for, the right for all freedom-loving people to have. Again, the 11th Circuit has one of the lowest rates granting oral arguments in only 13.6% of cases. I mean, if this tells you anything, it really tells you that, you know, this case is, I think that they said it's going to set case law, possibly. It's has an impact on the future of the First Amendment. And being able to bring you these live reports directly here in Atlanta from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals is something that you have to tune into and be a part of. So we're all very excited to hear about what's going on. I think that this is probably, you know, the most important case. This is the trial was the trial of the century. So we're following in that same trajectory. So visit theburningspear.com. You can also subscribe to the Burning Spear newspaper from theburningspear.com. More importantly, join the party if you align with the politics that you read in the Burning Spear. We have instructions there. And subscribe to the Burning Spear TV YouTube channel. We have an incredible team here that provides you with anti-colonial media, and we are pushing for higher viewership, and we are on the road to 10,000 followers, so we need you to be the next follower and subscribe.
Yeshitela and his attorneys, Leonard Goodman and Angela Rainey, had positive things to say about the legitimacy of this venue, but you shouldn't have to struggle so much for free speech.
It's an important case. These defendants were targeted for political speech. That's almost never happened. The Supreme Court has condemned these kind of prosecutions for almost 100 years. So I think we gave them a lot to think about in this appeal. We'll see where they end up, and we're hopeful.
Uhuru, Leonard did a great job presenting argument, and I think I echo his sentiments that this is a free speech case. This prosecution was in violation of their right to speak freely, and we'll wait to see what the court has to say. Thank you.
Uhuru, Chairman O'Malley Yeshitela.
Uhuru, thank you so much. I'm really appreciative of what has happened up to now, what happened in the court just now. We have extraordinary lawyers who presented extraordinary arguments to overturn this conviction, extraordinary conviction, I should say. I felt the arguments went well. Some people were concerned because the judges seem to be fixated on the issue of having not registered as a foreign agent. This is one of the things they convicted us of. It was an extraordinary conviction because we were found not guilty by a jury of actually working for Russian agents without notifying the Justice Department. And now we have a situation where we were found guilty of not registering to conspire to work for the Russia as a Russian agent. It's an extraordinary kind of conviction. The judge was saying this throughout the process. I am not pessimistic about how the discussions went today. And one of the things that impacts on the limitations of my of pessimism is one, that these cases are not heard regularly, ordinarily. The court doesn't take these arguments. And secondly, they seldom hear, give people an opportunity for oral arguments. So that was a good thing because we feel like the court itself recognized there's some issues that need resolution. And despite what we heard coming from the judges that might have made some people pessimistic, the court clearly felt like that these were issues that need resolution and that they are unresolved. So that was one thing that I felt good about. And the other thing, another thing I felt good about, in addition to the extraordinary job that was done by Comrade Leonard, Attorney Leonard Goodman, is the fact that the prosecution did not have a reasonable explanation for why we should be facing charges on the second offense, that is a conspiracy, while when we the court, the jury had found us not guilty of the foundational charge, and there was no meaningful response from the prosecution around that. So I felt like that was also part of what made me feel pretty good about what has transpired up to now. I should say this. The federal feds, the Justice Department, the FBI, they like to boast about the fact that they have something like a 97% conviction rate. And one of the reasons they have a 97% conviction rate is when people roll up to your houses with armored vehicles and flashbang grenades and using laser targeting devices for you, most people have simply surrendered. They have taken deals that the prosecution will offer you. People are intimidated so much that they often don't utilize what's supposed to be a constitutional right, to appear before a jury of your peers, etc. This instance, of course, it didn't go that way because we fought. And the reason we're standing here today is not because it's because of the fact that we resisted. The reason the court had to hear us today is because we resisted. And so the thing that I think fundamentally important here is that people need to understand that you have to fight injustices and you cannot be intimidated and fearful of what might happen if you fight injustices. And the first motion that was made to dismiss the indictment, I thought was really important by Attorney Leonard Goodman, is he said even the indictment itself is an attack on free speech. It's an attack on free speech. And nobody in this country has a connection to the struggle for free speech more than Black people.
That's right.
Because when you look at the issue of the First Amendment, the Bill of Rights of this, I think it was, 1797? When this was adopted by the U.S. Congress, at 1797, African people were property. So we had no rights. There was no assumption that it was for us. And this is what I'm hoping that particularly white people will come to understand, that they didn't, when they came with us around free speech issues that we never had, then it's not us ultimately that they're coming for. They're coming for you.
Yep.
because there's a presumption that you have free speech rights. And so when they attack free speech, First Amendment, et cetera, it's an attack on everybody. So I just think it's important. It's very good for us. Thank you so much. We've got extraordinary lawyers and here. Yeah, extraordinary. These some bad lawyers. Yeah. And so I'm so appreciative of all of you and everything that's transpired. We'll be talking a lot more when we're summing up debriefing as it's characterized. Uhuru.
You know, we're here today to change the law, ultimately. Yeah. We're here today to create new case precedent for generations to come. And that's an extremely hard thing to do. I can't tell you how appreciative and proud I was of Attorney Leonard Goodman for standing his ground in this quest for resistance against this injustice. He really presented our legal arguments well. He battled till the end, and I'm hopeful and confident that we will get the result that we are looking for. Well, thank you.
Just to note that is Attorney Addie Griffin.
Now that both sides have shared their stories, documents, and proof, the three impartial judges will review the law, look at the rules that apply to the case until a clear, enforceable decision is given to the end of the argument. For more info, go to handsoffuhuru.org. That's handsoffuhuru.org. Callie Ackland is a Navy veteran, tenant support specialist, and Springfield Planning Commission member who is running in the November 2026 election for the Springfield City Council Ward 4 seat. She works as a tenant support specialist at the nonprofit Springfield Eugene Tenant Association and serves on the Springfield Planning Commission, to which she was appointed in June 2025. Earlier in 2026, she applied for the interim Ward 4 City Council vacancy left by the resignation of Beth Blackwell. After council deliberations deadlocked, the city ultimately appointed Jill Quadros as the interim counselor on April 21, 2026, to serve through December 31, 2026. On Saturday, July 25th, at 6 p.m. at her kickoff event to an overflow crowd at the Springfield Public House, candidate Callie Ackland said she is tired of platitudes and saw the need to go back to the basics of potholes and picket fences.
I'm new at this. I'm getting comfortable with public speaking, so bear with me. First, I just want to thank everyone for being here and for showing your support, not just for me, but for the change that we're going to make here in Springfield. We're all here tonight because we know that the current system isn't working for us. And we're here tonight because it feels like the world is falling apart around us. And we are tired of being told that there's nothing that we can do about it. We're here because we believe that change is possible, especially when we come together and work for it. As the eldest of three, raised by a single disabled mother, perseverance and discipline has always been in my blood. I know what it's like to stretch a paycheck through the end of the month. I know what it's like to rely on a public library, not just for the free books, but for the air conditioning that my family couldn't afford during the summer.
Renting too.
And I know what it's like to be supported through difficult times from my community. And as the only member of my immediate family to graduate from high school, to me it felt like the only opportunity to create a better life for myself, and the only way to contribute to something good was to join the military. And so it was in the Navy that I not only found a passion for public service, but that I saw what is possible when a small group of people are devoted to a shared mission. And after I left the military and I moved back home to here to Oregon, I wanted to settle down in a small town that reminded me of home, and a town that is gonna be my forever home for the rest of my life. And that's why I chose Springfield, because it's just big enough to have everything that I need, but still small enough to feel like I can get to know everyone. And oh my gosh, look at all of you guys. Thank you all again so much for being here. This is just incredible. Springfield's motto is proud history, bright future. And it hasn't always been an easy history. It hasn't always been a happy history, but it is a proud history because Springfield has weathered through its ups and downs, and the people of Springfield are proud because of what we have persevered through together. And we're now facing new challenges, and as a city, we need bold leaders that will continue to build us up. And as a community, we must rededicate ourselves to building that brighter future that we want to see here in Springfield. Woo! And that idea of a brighter future is why I serve on the Springfield Planning Commission. It's why I work at the Springfield Eugene Tenant Association. It's why I fought so hard for our Springfield Public Library. And it's why I will continue to fight for all of us as your next Springfield City Councilor. But we do have a rough road ahead of us. At my job, I talk to thousands of people around Lane County every single day who are experiencing housing insecurity, people who can't afford to leave bad relationships, people who've had to miss work because of a medical emergency and now can't make rent, and families who are losing the roofs over their heads due to no fault of their own. We are experiencing a severe housing crisis, and it has many root causes, and we need elected officials who have lived through and understand these challenges. Like almost half of Springfielders, I rent my home, and that is why I am committed to improving the living conditions for our tenants and our working class homeowners. Yeah. And our roads. Yes. Our roads, they suck. That's the one thing every single person in Springfield can agree on. Our roads suck. There's $120 million of deferred maintenance for our Springfield streets, and that deferred maintenance amount continues to grow by $10 million a year. So we cannot continue to kick the can down the road. We have to add every bit that we can to our street maintenance so that we can bring that number down and create a better city. And lastly, speaking of public services, many of you know how dear the Springfield Public Library is to my heart and to many of yours. And the library recently had to cut 3 full-time staff positions and close an additional day of the week. The library is already one of the smallest departments in the city, but every dollar that's invested in the library returns $5 to the local economy. So to reduce our library is to reduce our commitment to a better, more literate, more prosperous future for all of us. And of course, it's easy to list our problems, and it's easy to claim that we're gonna magically fix them. But I'm not running on empty promises or platitudes. I'm running to be the change that I want to see. I'm coming in prepared with practical policy proposals, ready to actually stand up and fight for the Springfield that we deserve. To face these challenges, our city needs more income, not from continuing to raise taxes on our working families, but from growing our tax base as a whole. We need more people moving to Springfield, and we need more small businesses calling Springfield home. But in order to attract more people and in order to develop our local entrepreneurs, we must first create better living conditions, affordable homes, drivable roads, quality schools, and good paying jobs. Now, as a member of the Springfield Planning Commission, I've already helped to revamp our city's development code, making it easier to build the housing and infrastructure that our city desperately needs. The rebirth of our downtown, the Glenwood development, the growing business hubs of Gateway and Bob Straub, these projects are our city's future, and they need leaders who will nurture them, leaders who will rise to the occasion, who will work with our labor unions to ensure livable wages and strong benefits, leaders who will listen. Leaders who will listen to every voice and who are willing to put in the hard work so that each and every one of us can live in that brighter future that our city's motto promises. My name is Callie Ackland, and with your support, I'll be your next Springfield City Councilor.
Callie Ackland officially launched her campaign for the November 3rd, 2026 general election to secure the remaining 2 years of the Ward 4 term, running alongside interim incumbent Jill Quadros.